cereal. Janet Frame is one of New Zealand's most celebrated writers. The originality and power of her fiction meant that she was frequently considered for the Nobel Prize for Literature. But to the frustration of the media, her publisher and agent, she shunned public attention, making journalists even more interested in the circumstances of her committal to mental hospitals. In the early 1980s, in order to set the record straight, Janet Frame wrote her autobiography, An Angel at My Table. This radio adaptation by Anita Sullivan starts in 1963, the year Janet returned to New Zealand after the death of her father.
From the first place of liquid darkness, within the second place of air and light, I set down the following record. It is a mixture of fact and truths and memories of truths, and its direction is always towards the third place, where the starting point is myth. Walk up the path under the old ghost tree, that huge pine with the drooping branches. I walk in the porch, treading on last year's squashed pears. No one to gather them anymore. The old iron boot blast is still here. Dad's fishing bag, as I remember it. Fishy stink and scabbed inside with dried scales. And here are his thigh gumboots for wading in the shingle beds of Waitaki, Rakaia, Rangitata, Willow Glen. I didn't expect it to be the same. Yet how else could it be? My family, living and dead. Granddad Frame from Paisley, who made the boot last. My father, a Scots thistle seed in a New Zealand pasture. Lottie Clarice Godfrey, defying her Christadelphian faith to marry and become mother. To Myrtle first, then Bruddy, the one that died, me in 1924, Isabel and June.
God will help us.
Mother.
Consider the lilies of the field.
So deeply immersed in the family that she seemed seldom at home. Her world was forever past tense. But magically...
Look, kiddies!
She brought her childhood...
The flowers of the forest!
Can I see?
Her poems and songs...
The snowberry!
...into our present.
Look at the pattern. It's tiny.
Along with her humility, she led us to try to discover the heart of everything. Father worked on the railway. We shifted with the work. My first memory is of Outram, the house with the walnut tree, and Betty the cow. I remember the golden beastie grazing, and my most treasured possession, my gold velvet beastie dress. I remember a grey day when I stood and listened to the wind moan in the telegraph wires. I looked up and down the white dusty road and saw no one. The wind was blowing from place to place and I was there in between, listening. I felt a burden of sadness and loneliness as if something had happened or begun. I don't think I'd yet thought of myself as a person looking out at the world. Until then, I felt I was the world. We shifted from Outram to Glenham, accumulating new treasures. My secret place. New songs, with Dad playing bagpipes, Mum her accordion.
The lighthouse on the rocky shore.
Mum's poems.
The seagull's lonely cry.
Picnics on the beach.
And day departing leaves behind God's pictures in the sky.
Then came winter, with kerosene lamps and candles.
The southern lights,
pains,
kiddies.
Fevers, rats and bone-grinding cold.
Jack Frost is coming for your toe.
We shifted again, from Glenham to Edendale, then from Edendale to Wyndham. In Wyndham, I discovered that the world held more people than I had dreamed of. Wyndham also marked the end of my infancy and my introduction to the world of contradictions, where words assumed a special power. Began with the dentist, and as I remember, I hear the whining drill placed there for my future time, the sound of my fear across the years. The nurse comes closer, smiling, and says,
"Smell the pretty pink towel."
Unsuspecting, I do as she asks and find myself falling asleep. The words were a trap. They had not really meant "smell the pretty pink towel," but "I'm going to put you to sleep while I take your tooth out." Words had betrayed me, and I never forgot that deception.
Wyndham Primary.
And then there was starting school. During my first week, I took some coins from my father's trouser pocket and bought chewing gum. I gave each of my classmates a pillow.
"Billy Delamere, what are you eating?"
"Chewing gum from Janet Frame," he said, pointing at my red hair, red face.
"Janet Frame, where did you get the chewing gum?"
"From Heath's, Miss Botting," I said.
"And where did you get the money?"
"My father gave it to me."
"Where did you get the money?"
"My dad gave it to me."
"Come out here."
The words trapped me.
"Up onto the platform. Face the class. Now, tell the truth."
All morning I stayed on that platform right through lunchtime. I held out obstinately until mid-afternoon.
"Tell me the truth."
A small voice answered. I took the money out of my father's pocket. And so I learned that telling the truth could be as dangerous as lying.
"Faith!"
At home and at school, I was now called
Faith!
It happened that my branding as
Faith
coincided with inklings of the unfairness and injustice of the world. It was 1930. The Depression had begun, and the swaggers passed through Wyndham asking for food. Mother warned us.
"You mustn't laugh at people you think are funny. They might be angels."
"Angels?"
"The world is full of people in disguise."
"But what if he's not an angel, just a thieving beggar?"
"Then God still loves him, no matter how poor and peculiar he might be."
Perhaps God loved me too, for I was blessed with a fresh start. In 1931, we shifted from Wyndham to Eden Street, Oamaru. Eden. A garden. Seeing the long row of houses, electric lights, Mother panicked and spoke in her earthquake and lightning voice.
"Surrounded by houses. We've never been surrounded before."
We children made it our place. We ran, crawled and climbed. Over the red iron roof, under the house piles, through the maca carp hedge, up the plum trees, down the creek and into the pine plannies. Then back to the house with a pool flush lavatory and the summer house covered in roses, our very own theatre. Playing went on after school until dark.
"Shh, kiddies, your granddad is trying to sleep."
Even then, there were guessing and imagining games, arguments and fights and impossible dreams of fame. And at bedtime, there was reading aloud. Us four girls, all under one blanket. I could read well and loved adventure books like To the Island.
"It's Island."
"It's Island. I-S-L-A."
"It's a silent letter, Janet. Like me."
I accepted Myrtle's ruling because she was eldest. But within myself, it was still the Island. I was very particular about words. So when the teacher asked us to write a composition, My Adventure, I wrote about crossing the bull paddock. It never occurred to me that I was allowed to make up an adventure.
Tell the truth.
And I learned three new words just as powerful as adventure. Decide, destination, and observation. In fact, all three seem to be part of every story. When I found I could use this movement, this journey, to create adventures, my ever-shifting self was overjoyed.
Kiddies, enough! Your granddad needs quiet.
It's because he's dying.
Granddad Frame slept in the back room, his head wristed, tilted on his thin neck like a bird's. He kept his glasses in a case lined with rich blue velvet, which filled me with sadness. It was a colour like the evening sky that had no end. It was like the question I had begun to ask. Why was the world? Why was the world? Which immediately gave the dizzying thought of no world and plunging everlasting depths. Grandad died and was buried in the earth, and the grave sank.
It always sinks.
And then one night, Mother's earthquake and lightning voice,
he's having a convulsion,
announced something terrible.
Hold him! Hold him!
He'll drown!
Our lives were suddenly changed.
Get out! All of you! Go to your room!
Our brother had epilepsy. Buddy was stupefied with drugs and fits.
Buddy, you must eat.
No!
He was either convulsing or half asleep crying.
No!
Or alone in a rage of confusion. At home he was helpless, at school he was bullied. And we girls avoided the horror, the fits and the no cure. Eventually Buddy had to leave school. Mother devoted all her time to him and the bagpipe and accordion days were over. Anyone observing me then would have seen an anxious child full of twitches and tics. I stood alone in the playground, wearing the same hand-me-down kilts, stiff with constant wear. Then the hospital and doctor's bills came in.
I'll go down and jump over the wharf.
None of that talk, Curly. Consider the lilies of the field. God will help us.
He better get lively then.
One day,
see this plant?
I found a friend.
The juice cures warts.
Poppy had an ugly face.
And this one's called Fat Hen.
But she gave a name.
That's Lupin.
A voice.
And this one.
To everything.
Poppy, that's someone's garden.
An outside fence.
But it's stealing.
Catching. It's different. I catch flowers all the time.
Janet, let's see my best book.
Poppy lent me her Grimm's fairy tales.
Listen to this. Once upon a time, there was a king who had 12 beautiful daughters.
My three sisters listened while I read.
But every morning, their shoes were quite worn through.
And I knew and they knew gloriously that
we are the dancing princesses.
For there was Dad, bent over the bootlass, saying,
your soles are worn right through. Where have you been?
Where indeed? Myrtle brought us forbidden magazines to read under the covers.
And when she appeared on the moonlit veranda...
Of course, it was all true. Yet while we devoured fairy tales of all kinds, we were also hungry for information.
Mum, what did you do when you got married?
Your father and I jumped over a broomstick.
But where did the babies come from?
From the stork. Now go and lay the table.
Fortunately, Poppy had all the answers.
You screw, kiddo. What's that?
In the spirit of adventure, Myrtle and Poppy's brother Ted tried to do it in the plannies. We watched with interest. And over dinner, anxious as ever to share the day's events, I said,
Myrtle and Ted did it this afternoon.
Did what?
Screwed, kiddo.
Right, lass!
Oh, don't hit it, Curly!
You're coming with me, come on!
And he dragged Myrtle into the bedroom. She was only 12, but she already had her monthlies. We listened, terrified, while Dad belted her. and afterwards the doctor examined her. That night, like the night of Buddy's first illness, affected a change in our lives.
Poppy, I'm not allowed to speak to you ever again.
And I'm not allowed to speak to you either.
Here's your book, Beck.
Thank you.
Myrtle and I became closer. She was entering her proficiency year, and Dad warned her that if she didn't pass, she'd go to the woolen mills. An empty threat, as he couldn't afford senior high school anyway. But Myrtle would argue back about everything.
You tell her not to do it, but she'll do it just the same.
Wearing lipstick?
Forbidden.
Going downtown on Friday night?
Forbidden.
Chewing gum?
You'll get the belt.
Okay, Chief.
Myrtle wanted to be an actress, an ability she proved by reciting her poem on the radio.
I meet at eve the Prince of Sleep. His was a still and lovely face.
She spoke all seven verses by heart, and so was
halfway to becoming a film star. And I have good legs. I can run fast.
And swim.
So I'll be strong enough to be at MGM Studios sharp at 6 each morning and dance at Hollywood parties all night.
In your backless.
Then, when she was running in the school sports, she collapsed and was brought home. The doctor said she had a heart defect.
Our Myrtle? No, that's impossible.
For a time, we watched and waited. But Myrtle didn't stop breathing, and soon we forgot. But she was no longer thought strong enough to work at the mill, and so she became a domestic help.
So that worked out all right?
Meanwhile, Bruddy was ill. Day after day and night after night. Mother struggled to look after him and find a cure. She was beset by expert advice.
It could be his spine.
His eyes.
His ears.
And he's no better, is he?
While Mother's search continued, we kiddies ran wild. We became members of gangs and secret societies, rushing around town with Myrtle's lassie and Bruddy's laddie in a yelling, barking pack. It couldn't last. The neighbours, complaining of dogs jumping in and out of our windows, sent for the health inspector. He found chaos and filth.
While I have every sympathy for your predicament, Mrs. Frame, if something is not done, I will be forced to send the girls to welfare. For the good of the family, Mrs. Frame, I strongly advise sending the boy to Seacliff Hospital.
Seacliff? Never. Never. No child of mine will ever go to that place.
So the dogs were put in sacks and drowned in the creek. And Isabel, June and I settled into our new school year. I was now 9 years old, in Gussie Dimmock's class. And inexplicably,
Janet,
the teacher's pet.
Come and sit at the front by me.
It had always been other children who had been teachers' pets. Pretty little girls with clean hair ribbons.
Does anyone know why?
I was not pretty. My hair was a red frizz and my clothes were dirty. I never discovered the reason for his choice, unless he thought it was the only way to deal with my tics and terrors.
That's right, Janet. Well done. Now, I want you all to write a poem of your own starting When the Sun Goes Down and the Night Draws Nigh.
And evening shadows touch the sky. My first poem.
You shouldn't say touch. That's not right. In a poem, you say tint.
But shadows don't tint.
It's poetic expression, Dalt. Shadows always tint, stars twinkle, waves lap, and the wind roars.
She was so self-assured with her job and her slacks, I had to agree. Although for Gussie, I kept my word. Touched.
That's excellent, Janet.
Under Gussie's care, I blossomed. I was Ducks of the School 1934, first. I was presented with a medal and a year's subscription to the Oamaru Athenaeum, the town library. I'd never seen so many books. I choose Grimm's Fairy Tales, a William book for Bruddy, a detective story for Dad.
Oh, Sexton Blake, thank you, Janet.
And a Dickens for Mum.
Born in poverty and growing up to be a great writer. Tunic, blouses, black...
Going to junior high meant a new uniform.
Pants, shoes.
She'd be better off working at the mill.
She won the Ducks. She's going to be a teacher like Cousin Peg. We'll have to manage.
Mother bravely made a tunic, a disastrous hybrid garment with a yawning yoke. And then 1935 saw the election of a Labour government with social security.
Free healthcare!
Free hospitals!
It was like the second coming. Dad did a spontaneous dance of delight and thrashed the medical bills in the fire. It was too late for Myrtle, but my education was secure. In my first year at Waitaki Junior High, I made up my mind to be a poet.
Only the poets know, kiddies. Only the poets.
This renewed interest was prompted by our teacher, Miss Lindsay, who was devoted to verse speaking.
Mum, we had Ring Out the Wild Bells today.
Ring out wild bells to the wild sky, the flying cloud, the frosty light.
The year is dying, let him die. We had that too.
Myrtle was homesick for a world she'd lost.
Of course, I have a book of poems accepted by Stockwell's Ilfracombe, England.
We know, Mum.
Her joy faltered, knowing she could never afford the publication fee. Just as Myrtle knew she would never be an actress.
The pine trees whisper as they sway.
It's no surprise my own early poems were about days gone by.
Sadly lonely through the day, bringing back sweet memories.
The summer put us back in the present, back together. Away on Dad's railway pass for a week's camping in Rakaia.
Rakaia, kiddies, the snow-fed river.
We explored, up all the gum trees.
The tides run up the Wairau.
Mum sat in the sun, tending the billy and making up funny rhymes about dead salmon fishing. Myrtle and Dad stopped fighting. And Brody only had one fit.
Smile, everyone!
Smile!
We were happy. When the photographs of our holiday were developed, Mother gasped. Myrtle appeared to be transparent while everyone else was flesh and blood. That year, 1936, there was a polio epidemic. Junior high could not reopen and summer blazed on with bluestone skies.
Come on, it's glorious. Come to the bath for a swim.
No.
I'll pay you in.
I'm doing schoolwork.
Oh, Daddy's a little duck's pet. Going to be a teacher. You're so boring, Janet.
So are you. I don't want to sit looking at boys in their togs. We did that all summer. Go with Isabel.
Okay, I will. She's more my type anyway.
And she went. I continued to study until late afternoon when...
Mrs. Frayne. I'm a doctor. It's about your daughter, Myrtle. She's been drowned. They've taken her body to the morgue.
The morgue?
At first I was glad. There'd be no more quarrels with us frightened and crying. But then she didn't come home that night.
I met at eve the Prince of Sleep. His was a still and lovely face.
To bring in her shoes, cleaned with the whitener and left to dry in the sun.
A lonely place.
And I understood then that the price of peace was Myrtle's entire removal from the face of the earth. After the inquest, her body came home.
Do you want to see Myrtle?
No.
The fear, and after, the regret.
We will see her on Resurrection Day, Janet.
Myrtle was buried. In time, the ink on the cards ran, the ribbons rotted, the grave sank.
It always sinks.
And school opened again.
Beautiful Evelyn Hope is dead. Sit and watch by her side an hour. That is her bookshelf, this her bed.
I discovered that many of the poets knew about Myrtle's death. And how strange it was without her.
She plucked that piece of geranium flower.
The poets exaggerated, though, for Myrtle had not really been beautiful or anyone's darling. She was just my teasing, pinching elder sister.
Yet once more, ye laurels, and once more, ye myrtles.
But hearing her name in class sent such a piercing shock through me that I clenched my toes and gripped my hands on the lid of my desk to stop myself bursting into tears.
Now thou art gone, and never must return.
Myrtle's passing did not bring peace. Fearful, my father turned all his anger on Braddy.
But ask you to do an hour's graft. Oh, no, that'll bring on a fit.
He can't help it, Curly.
Rolling in the dirt like a dog.
It's his condition.
You spoil him. That's his condition.
With so much change around me, it seemed natural that the ruling about Poppy should change too. So passing on the street corner, we spoke.
You've heard I'm taking commercial?
Yes.
I'm doing shorthand, typing and double entry bookkeeping.
Do you like it?
How could she?
We do grammar logs all the time.
Ah.
But we're having ode to a nightingale. Thou was not born for death.
The word swept out of Poppy like a cry of panic. I remembered her gift of Brim's Tales all those years ago. This was her parting gift. I didn't know how to receive it. Because I didn't understand it. And we hurried to our different worlds. My first year at Waitaki High School began with the usual worries about money, my rotten teeth and my tunic.
It's too tight, Mum.
No, it's fine.
It's squashing my breasts.
It'll just have to do. We can't buy a new one. Well, just for a few months.
I, now the eldest girl, did my best to smooth the surface of life at home, to agree and smile, do chores, go fishing with Dad and talk about the latest Sexton Blake. So I put on my too-tight uniform and face the scrutiny of...
And of course patent leather is best.
Oh yes.
The group.
And buckles. Never laces.
Laces are for farm girls.
The group's fathers were doctors and auctioneers with cribs on the coast. Their power and happiness flowed from them. They were able to impose their taste in dress, manners, leisure activities, films and books.
You must read the new Georgette Heyer. It's based on a true story.
I drew the line at Georgette Heyer, my one rebellion. But I submitted to the group's judgment in all other matters, just as I submitted to the tastes of the poets. I wrote my own verses replete with their dreams and dawns and flowers, their soft, deep, old, grey, little tints.
Omaru is the kingdom by the sea, from the poem Annabel Lee.
Jean's so original.
Was I? Certainly life at home, with the terrifying episodes of my brother's illness, was unlike that of my classmates.
You frame girls think you're so different from everyone else.
So the idea of difference, given to me by others in a time when I did not know myself, was powerful. I came to accept it. Although in our world of school, to be different was to be peculiar, a little mad. I was conscious too of my physical difference, my too tight tunic, dirtied with cow muck, my bad teeth and cobble-mended stockings, and my hair.
No one else has red hair like yours.
It grows up like an African's.
Oh my, why don't you straighten it?
Can't you put oil in it or something?
It's so fuzzy.
I didn't need to read Georgette Heyer to put myself in a costume drama. I only had to sit on the stone bench of Waitaki Girls Senior High.
We don't care if the school falls down. No more English, no more French. No more sitting on the old school bench.
By the summer holidays, Myrtle disappeared almost without trace. I could see only the white centipede scar on her knee. Her golden hair. She'd been so fearless, challenging, as Isabel was growing up to be. Whereas my only place of rebellion was within, in an imagination that I was not even sure I possessed.
When shall we three meet again? In thunder, lightning, or in rain?
My second year at high school, 1938, began with Miss Farney, who cast me as Lady Macbeth.
Here's the smell of the blood still. All the perfumes of Arabia will not sweeten this little hand. Oh, oh, oh!
I never did perform it before the school. But one morning, I used Mother's earthquake and lightning voice to announce...
There's blood between my legs.
It's your monthlies.
And Mother cut an old bath towel into rectangular strips.
Pin that to your singlet, front and back.
It will show.
No, it won't.
I knew it showed. Bought sanitary towels were unheard of in our household, so I suffered those bulky strips of toweling.
Yet, here's a spot.
But the afternoon smell of stale menstrual blood.
Janet.
And the unceasing shame.
Janet.
What's funny?
Oh, Janet, so dreamy, so shy.
Shy? I seized this poetic attribute and made shyness a part of my personality.
Poetry is everywhere, girls. Here and now. Mathematics can be poetry. Poetry exists where few search for it.
I realised that poetry was not an escape from the reality. There was no removal of myself to another world. There was simply the world's arrival into my own. For how else could I anchor that world here where I knew it belonged? In Oamaru, the kingdom by the sea.
But if the British Empire and its Commonwealth last for 1,000 years...
Had I been a city, the shock of war would have torn apart all the buildings.
I don't care what Mother says, I'm going to sign up.
Who's afraid to have you, buddy? Aha! Here they are. My old putties. I used to keep out the mud from the trenches.
He seldom talked of the trenches. It was a word Mum used to explain why Dad was so often sad or angry. Flags appeared on the buildings. Men became our boys. Even Mother, the pacifist, clenched her fist and said,
"We'll show Hitler."
While I accepted the shallow glorification of the dead in Flanders fields. My own poems were published in the local newspaper. I described a dire event with the latest poetic words in my vocabulary, dreaming, boyish, sweet, with the old standbys of lovely and little. Like me, Mother turned increasingly to her poets for shelter.
As our own Thomas Bracken says, New Zealand as God's own country.
Bracken? He was Irish, Mum, and he wrote about sheep.
And dear Eileen Duggan, she started as a school teacher, Janet.
At a Catholic school.
Oh!
My criticism left her flushed and unhappy, and I felt a savage joy, for I was asserting my finer poetic identity.
Today I wept in class when we were reading The Soldier.
If I should die...
My weeping was not audible.
Think only this of me, that there's some corner of a foreign field...
Although I hoped the teacher might see me wiping away a tear and think...
Ah, there's Janet, so moved by poetry, so imaginative, a real poet.
When my beloved cat Winkles died, I naturally seized the opportunity to write an elegy. In spite of my dreams, I knew that I would have to train as a teacher, for teachers, unlike university students, were paid.
Now, turn over your papers and begin.
But I did pass the university entrance exam, which I remember chiefly for the fee.
2 guineas? You're 17 years old. It's time you left school and learnt the value of money.
A few years later, my first published story, University Entrance, earned me exactly that sum.
Time's up. Stop writing and put your papers face down on your desk.
In my earlier years, time had been horizontal, progressive. Adolescent time was a whirlpool. I struggled with those last years at school. I felt bewildered, imprisoned. Where would I go? What was the world like? How could it be at war? Why was the world? Why was the world?
So, Miss Frame, why do you think you would make a good teacher?
Well, Principal Partridge, I like school.
I try to be bright and teacherly.
And I've always been a good student. I was school ducks.
Ah.
Principal Partridge was impressed.
And house captain. A captain of the B basketball team.
Probably seeing the uncomplicated girl, which I was not. He gave me a place.
Loads of other stuff.
At Dunedin Training College.
You're lucky.
Isabel was getting rather worldly.
Lots of girls have to leave school early and they go to work, like Myrtle did.
I hadn't noticed.
And there's lots of rotten teeth and funny uniforms too. You're not so different, Fuzzy.
When I stopped wearing my school tunic after 6 years of almost constant wear, I felt naked as a skinned rabbit. And so the future, towards which our teachers had directed their urging threats and long-lost ambitions, had begun. It was now the present, the Island from which there is no escape.
Tickets! All tickets, please!
I took the Sunday slow train down the coast to Dunedin, my first city.
Any more tickets for Omaru?
I'd be living with Aunt Izzy and Uncle George in Garden Terrace. I imagined rose bushes, a view from my window of the peninsula, my own desk. I would attend training college and university in my spare time, and everyone would recognise me as a true poet and...
Seacliff! This is Seacliff!
I glimpsed a castle of dark stone.
That's the asylum, up there.
Look, there's the loonies.
Where? Which ones?
It's hard to tell.
Oh, I hope they don't get on the train.
We left them behind. Those had been sent down the line.
Dunedin service.
I wondered, would it be up the line if you're from Dunedin?
Last stop, Dunedin.
Dunedin was half hidden in misty rain. Brick and concrete buildings, tall chimneys layered across the sky.
Aunt Izzy?
Janet, come in.
Full Garden Terrace was small as a doll's house.
Oh, we're so looking forward to your stay. We're so proud you're going to be a teacher.
I smiled while trying to hide my decaying teeth.
Uncle George is in bed.
Uncle George had cancer.
Would you like to see him? George? Janet has come to say hello.
You're the one who's going to be a teacher?
Yes, Uncle George.
I noted the grey pallor of his face and wondered what dreadful sight was concealed beneath the bedclothes.
I'll show you to your room, Janet. He spends most of his time in bed now, so it will be just you and I for meals.
Oh, no.
I was shy.
That's quite all right.
And so very anxious to be thought the perfect lodger.
I eat very little. In fact, I'm a vegetarian.
Oh.
And I'll be frightfully busy. I'll eat in my room.
Well, if you're sure. Here it is. Make yourself at home.
The tiny room looked out over brick walls. If I leaned out the window, I could just see a bit of sooty geraniums. So this was how it was. The future. Alone. Afraid of the city and training college and having to pretend everything is quite all right and that teaching is what I had longed to do all my life. That first assembly, the attitudes and customs of my new world, all this produced in me a euphoria of belonging, which was intensified and contradicted by my actual feeling of isolation.
So, you're living in one of the hostels?
No, Principal Partridge, I stay with my aunt and uncle.
It's not always good to stay with relatives, is it nearby?
Garden Terrace, Carroll Street.
An Assyrian quarter. Not savoury at all. And you want to take two university courses, English and French. You do understand that teacher training college is full-time.
Yes, Mr. Partridge.
And doing well at school does not mean you will do well at university.
I will work hard.
Yes.
Reluctantly, he gave his permission. And his disapproval tore painfully at the perfect edge of my new world. The college building defeated me. It was too new, naked and clean. The common room was so vast I felt unable to enter. I was overawed by the lavatories. One had to walk, soiled sanitary towel in hand, from the lavatory across the tiled, echoing floor to the incinerator. I carried my towels home to be thrown in the cemetery, along with the wrappers from the caramello chocolate I secretly ate in my room. I was always hungry.
The plot of Measure for Measure is a comedy of disguise.
University was more intimate than college.
But it is crammed.
I was not called upon to behave like a teacher.
With sexual struggle and comment.
I could just listen.
With decisions affecting life.
Dreaming about the subject of the lecture and, at times, the lecturer.
Death and destiny.
Concentration was intense.
Crammed with sexual struggle.
A bit like this lecture theatre.
I was ignorant of the ways of love and sex. I watched with wonder the female students who, finding their man, fulfilled not only their own expectations, but those of their family and friends.
What's yet in this that bears the name of life? Yet in this life lie hid more thousand deaths. Yet death we fear, that makes these odds all even.
My visits home became fewer. On the way home, I'd imagined that all would be peaceful, different. But as soon as I arrived, I wish I had not come. The antagonism between my father and my brother had increased. My self-effacing mother maintained her role as peacemaker and provider.
That's sublimination.
What's that?
Freud. You're frustrated sexually, mother.
Oh!
Your superego tells you that, but your id disagrees.
So, that's what they teach you at teacher training?
It's varsity, Dad. We study Freud for Lit Crit.
I try to use the language, try to use we when I talked of my life as a student, but it was futile. I had moved from the second person plural to a shadowy I, almost a nothingness, like a no-woman's land.
Well, Auntie Izzy says you're a lovely girl, no trouble at all. She scarcely knows you're in the house.
During that summer, students were manpowered for the war effort. I was excited by the idea of going up Central, climbing into the clouds. The reality was a long journey in an old bus through a moonscape of bare hills to a fertile plain. By the banks of a turbulent, churned white river, the Clutha.
The snow-fed river, kiddies. The tides run up the Wairau.
Snow green, blue, mud brown, and borrowing rainbows from light, with a burden rising from its power of the dead. Uprooted vegetation, the bodies of sheep, deer, and from time to time, people. After a year confined in the city, I felt the river was an ally, that it would speak for me. While we picked fruit, the farmer's sons strode among us like younger gods. I watched their eyes, their hands, glanced at the snowgrass bulge between their legs.
What's it called? The pond?
Metagowrie.
It wasn't beautiful. It was a stunted desert thorn bush with leaves like tarnished flakes of snow. But under the dominion of the sun, I fell in love with
Metagowrie.
The memory remains, the bounty of the river, the flawless blue of the sky. When I returned home to Oamaru, my summer love rapidly cooled. Isabel was preparing for her first year. Both she and I would be staying with Aunt Izzy.
If you start making puppy eyes and going all the way...
Isabel and I were good friends.
Well, you're asking for trouble.
But I felt alarm at her very first move.
Of course, I'm coming to training college straight from fifth form. I don't know why everyone doesn't do it.
Because enduring sixth form is a discipline for life. You're only 17, Isabel.
I've seen more life than you.
I saw my carefully cemented world crumbling under the force of Isabel's unexpected wither. It was hard work studying at both training college and university. The social studies assignment alone on the growth of the cities was to be the length of a book. I needed Isabel to behave, to obey, to study, so people would say...
Those Frame girls are two of our best teachers.
Janet and Isabel, no trouble, no trouble at all.
I needed her to accept without complaining the conditions I had set at Garden Terrace.
We're paying 10 shillings a week for this dump.
Shh!
Oh, I'm telling Mum.
Please, don't say anything.
There was a storm of letters.
Aunt Izzy is starving us. She makes us share a tiny bed in a tiny room. We're frozen day and night.
And nothing but scraps and vegetables.
I was mistaken in thinking they were lovely girls.
Always thought you were better than us.
Liars. Thieves. And no wonder, the way they were raised, those ungrateful savages. Ate all my chocolates.
We did eat all her chocolates.
Because we were starving hungry.
Isabel left in triumph to live among friends in a boarding house and go roller skating with her boyfriend. I left with shame and loss. No longer a lovely girl, no trouble at all. I went to the only other place available. A hostel cubicle. And I felt sad to have lost her. The hostel was noisy and distracting, and I was struggling with growth of cities. While cultivating my poetic spirit, I had become impatient with boring factual detail. I procrastinated with 2 poems for the critic, one of which won a 10-shilling prize. Growth of cities emerged as a geographical, historical and social version of The Waves, appliqued with illustrations cut from magazines. It had a mixed reception. At home, it was heard that the lease on Eden Street would not be renewed. Some memories have been diluted, mostly by the storms that followed. So I don't remember the search for a new house, but it must have been desperate. On the brink of eviction, Dad took shares in a newly formed building society.
They have a monthly ballot. We may get a loan.
Mother, who never had any personal money, contributed her faith.
God knows what you have need of, even before you ask.
And miraculously, the following ballot produced a loan of £300. It was just enough to buy a rat-ridden, ramshackle cottage with 3.5 acres known as...
Willow Glen.
Tis the season to be jolly.
Our own house, kiddies.
If we keep up the payments.
It's got a buyer.
Even in summer, the house was dark, cold and cramped.
Fruit trees, a creek.
But down by the creek, the sun stayed into the evening. I pleaded for Mother to come down on the flat and enjoy the warmth.
Not today,
she always said, as if it were a distant dream. Like publication or the second coming.
One of these days, in the cool of the evening, I'll go down on the flat in the sun.
Word came in January that for my probationary year, I was to teach Standard 2 at Arthur Street, Dunedin City. I delighted in the children and in teaching. I revelled in their art and poetry, which I pinned around the walls. I took pains, too, in teaching other subjects.
Once upon a time, there were 4 dancing princesses. Il y avait une fois et un temps pour moi.
My failure was as a member of staff. I was too timid to go to morning or afternoon tea in the teacher's room. I was anxious about being visited by the headmaster, and I dreaded the end-of-year inspection. The only escape from my fears was the psychology class, supervised by...
I'm John Forrest, and this is Peter Prince. I do the introductions because Peter's an introvert.
John Forrest wore a rust-coloured sports coat and tomato-red socks.
You see, that's the exciting thing about psychology.
Some of the women swooned over him.
We are the subject matter, all of us.
I preferred Peter Prince because introverts are more artistic.
We can actually do many practical demonstrations right here in the seminar.
But it was John Forrest who arranged the weekly gramophone recitals in the music department.
All those records and no one hearing them.
The first recital was Tchaikovsky's Symphonie Pathétique. I discovered that listening to a symphony was like reading a book, with all its progressions, its shape, its silence and noise. I learned the language of classical music and could say blithely,
Adagio? Did you like the Adagio? That Andante passage?
The music room became another place where I felt at home. In spite of the worries about teaching and my future, I was happy. It was the year of my 21st birthday. The year the war, which had ground through my adolescence, ended. And the atom bomb was born in ashes and dust. Then one bright morning from a blue sky came the inspection. I greeted the inspector in my teacherly fashion. I stood by the display of paintings while he talked to the class. And when he settled down to watch my performance as a teacher, I said,
"Will you excuse me a moment, please?"
I walked out of the room and out of the school. I was drunk with pure freedom.
I'm a little on the lonely, a little on the lonely side.
I arranged 3 weeks' leave and went to university classes, to music recitals.
And wishing you
I read and wrote. At the end of my third week, school again loomed before me.
There's no one.
I had woven so carefully, with such close texture, the visible layer of...
No trouble at all. A quiet student, always happy.
...that even I could not break the thread of my deceit.
Every letter...
On Saturday evening, I tidied my room, arranged my possessions, and swallowed a packet of Aspros. I lay down in bed to die, certain that I would die.
I'm a little on the lonely side tonight.
The next morning, near noon, I woke. My first thought was not even a thought.
I'm alive. Alive.
I began to vomit again and again. I slept until Monday morning and woke with a slight headache. I was so overjoyed to be alive. School seemed a minor problem. I simply resigned. It happened that part of our psychology course was the writing of a condensed autobiography. I wondered, should I mention my attempt at suicide? I had recovered, and I was now rather proud of it for having been so daring. I added it as a postscript. To make it more impressive, I used the chemical term acetyl salicylic acid instead of aspirin. At the end of class,
Janet,
John Forrest stopped me.
I did enjoy your autobiography. All the others were so formal, but yours... You certainly have a talent for writing.
I do write. I've had a story in The Listener.
You must have had trouble swallowing all those Aspros.
Oh, I drink them with water.
Later that evening, as I was preparing for bed, I had a visit from John Forrest, Peter Prince, and the head of department.
Mr. Forrest tells me you haven't been feeling very well.
I'm fine, thank you.
No trouble at all.
We thought you might like to come with us to Dunedin Hospital for a few days' rest.
Suddenly, I felt free from all worry. Cared for. Oh, I could think of nothing more desirable than lying in bed, sheltered and warm, away from teaching and money, away from my family and my worry over them, away from my increasing isolation.
John will come and visit you.
John?
For little talks.
I was admitted to Dunedin Hospital, to a psychiatric ward. The nurses were kind.
This is your bed, Janet.
The doctors were questioning and concerned. Two ambulance men moved the most troublesome patient to Seacliff.
Don't worry, you won't be going there. There's nothing wrong with you, Janet.
And after 3 weeks' observation,
you can go home.
Suddenly, all the worries of the world returned. What could I do? How could I be myself? Where could I be?
You should pack your things.
Home. With the fits and violence, the anger and sadness, the alliances, peacemaking, secret sacrifice, toil and guilt. And
Janet?
Mother, hesitating in the doorway of the mental ward with her pitiful hat and her fearful...
I've come to take you home.
Home.
Go away.
The last place on earth I could be.
Go away.
Who was so firm...
Just go away.
So constant...
Go away.
...that this coil...
Go away from here. Get,
...would not infect his reason.
Get her out of here. Okay. This way, Mrs. Frame. No, I'm her mother. I'm sorry, Mrs. Frame. I don't understand.
No one asked me why I had screamed at my mother.
She's such a happy person.
No one told me that the alternative to home...
She's always been such a happy person.
I'm so sorry.
...was committal to Seacliff.
In An Angel at My Table by Janet Frame, adapted for radio by Anita Sullivan, Janet the narrator was played by Lorraine Ashbourne, young Janet, Bella Good, Janet as a teenager, Anna Skellen, mother, Barbara Ewing, father, Dennis Lill, Miss Botting, Federe Holmes, John Foster, Mike Sengalo, high school girls, Brianna Cox and Georgia Rippon, the students, Tara Goulding Weston Webb and Geraldine Wilkins, Myrtle Isabel Stewart, Poppy Layla Barber, young Isabel Molly Doyle, older Isabel Celeste Wong, young Bruddy Peter McKenzie, and older Bruddy William Alexander. You also heard students from Houghton Valley School and Wellington High School, New Zealand. The associate producer was Andrew Foster, and the producer was Karen Rose. An Angel at My Table was a Sweet Talk production for BBC Radio 4.